Jesus and Divine Prosperity Satara.
Mandeham Sri Guru Sri Uttama Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Praganatam Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Rodita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Panchaka Pachupascha Kripasindaviya Vitapaditanam Pavanevya Vaishnavevya Namah. Jai Jai Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
Jaya
Dvaita
Chandra Jaya
Gaura
Bhakta Vrinda
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya Jaya Nityananda
Jaya Jaya Sri Chaitanya
Jaya Nityananda Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda
Jaya Dvaita Chandra Jaya Gaura Bhakta Vrinda.
That's 114, okay. So September 10th, 2023, in ISKCON Soho, Thiruvananthapuram, Dhaneshwar. And we're reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Adi Lila, Chapter 7, Text 114. Chandra dosha nahi tenya agna kadidasha. Araye sune tara haya sarvanasha.
Araye sune tara haya sarvanasha.
Tanra, his, Lord Shiva's,
dosha,
fault,
nahi,
there is none,
tenho,
he, agyakari,
obedient order carrier.
That literally means someone who carries the order in their hands. Dasa,
servant.
Ada,
others.
Yay,
anyone.
Shune,
hears
the Mayavada philosophy.
Tara,
of him.
Haya,
becomes.
Sarvanasha,
everything lost. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Sankaracharya, who is an incarnation of Lord Shiva, is faultless because he is a servant carrying out the orders of the Lord. But those who follow his Mayavada philosophy are doomed. They will lose all their advancement in spiritual knowledge. So before I read this purport, which is 2.5 pages long and extremely complex, I'd like to tell you a little story about this chapter, which I hope that on hearing this story, you will be able to be a little bit more attentive to this extremely difficult purport. So I joined the Hare Krishna movement in 1973, and soon after I joined, this chapter came out as a separate book. So Prabhupada didn't actually publish the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita till later, till 1975. But this one chapter, Adi Lila Chapter 7, Lord Chaitanya and Five Features, was published. And as a very new member of the Hare Krishna movement, I devoured it, as I always done with anything that was in writing. And I really went into it very deeply. I took notes and so forth and so on. So in those days, we didn't get very many people from India coming to the temple. Some, but not so many. So one Sunday feast, this Indian gentleman came for the first time to a Hare Krishna temple, and he happened to be speaking to me. And he was propounding the Mayavad philosophy that is countered in this chapter. And it was almost as if he had read the same chapter, because he was offering... He was giving practically all the same arguments that are being given here in Srila Prabhupada's purports. And I had just read this, and I was young. I was 18, and my brain was still fresh. And I had studied it very thoroughly. So every single argument that he gave, I countered it from something that Prabhupada gave. You know, what he gave, I'm like, okay, I read that in the purport. Okay, and this is how Prabhupada responded in the purport. And so I gave the response, and we were talking for, I don't know, 45 minutes to an hour. And afterwards, he looked at me, and he said, "You are the most intelligent person I have ever met." And I was able 100% to say, none of this is my intelligence. All of this is the intelligence of A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada.
And then he came more and more to the temple. I don't know whatever happened to him in the long run, but he started regularly coming to the temple. So yes, this is difficult. Undoubtedly, it's very technical. It's highly philosophical. It's not like sweet Leela stuff, okay? But it is worth paying attention to. Catch Srila Prabhupada's purport. Mayavadi philosophers are very proud of exhibiting their Vedanta knowledge through grammatical jugglery. In other words, they take the verses and they reinterpret them. They say, oh, actually this pronoun refers to this and this. But in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Sri Krishna certifies that they are maya paditta jnana, bereft of real knowledge due to maya. Maya has two potencies with which to execute her two functions. Does anyone know the two potencies?
Covering and throwing.
Excellent. Covering and throwing, yes. The prakshet atpika shakti, the power to throw the living entity into the ocean of material existence, which, by the way, implies that the living entity was not always there. And the avarna atmika shakti, the power to cover the knowledge of the living entity. The function of the aran atmika shakti is explained in the Bhagavad Gita by the word maya paritta jnana. So that's the covering potency. In other words, you're reading the shastras, but you're covered. Maya paritta jnana, your knowledge is covered. Why the diving maya or illusory energy of Krishna takes away the knowledge of the Mayavadi philosophers is also explained in the Bhagavad Gita by the use of the words asuram bhavam ashritaha. By the way, so maya parigyana and asuram bhava ashritaha are both part of a verse that's talking about what? People who don't understand it. I mean, I'm not well. My ears are clogged up, and some of my hearing is hopefully very temporarily impeded. So you need to talk a little loudly. So people who don't surrender to Krishna, right? Krishna gives four types who surrender and four types who don't. And so Prabhupada here is mentioning two types who don't, which refer to a person who does not agree to the existence of the Lord. So Srila Prabhupada's, that's helpful. So Srila Prabhupada's classifying these Mayavadi philosophers both as having their knowledge covered and being demons. The Mayavadis who are not in agreement with the existence of the Lord can be classified in two groups. Now he's giving another two classifications. So he gave the Asuram Bhavam Ashritaha and the Maya Paritta Jnana. Now he's giving another two groups. Exemplified by the impersonalist Sankarites of Varanasi and the Buddhists of Sadanata. Both groups are Mayavadis, and Krishna takes away their knowledge due to their atheistic philosophies. Neither group agrees to accept the existence of a personal God. The Buddhist philosophers clearly deny both the soul and God, and although the Sankarites do not openly deny God, they say that the Absolute is Nidakar, or formless. Thus both the Buddhists and the Sankarites are Avasuddha Buddhaya, or imperfect and unclean in their knowledge and intelligence. Does anyone know where Prabhupada's pulling this phrase Avasuddha Buddhaya is from? Because he's not citing the reference here.
Bhagavad Gita.
Excuse me?
Bhagavad
Gita. It's in the 10th canto, yes? Yes, yes. And where is that?
11th canto.
No, it's 10th.
10th.
Hmm?
It's prayers by the demigods.
It is prayers. I'm pretty sure it's by Lord Brahma, but it might be by the demigods. But you might be right. The most now, right now in the world in 2023, do we have a huge influence of these two groups?
Yes.
Especially in terms of preventing spirituality to the general public. So a lot of people in the general public have become, shall we say, frustrated with religion, both in philosophy and in practice and in behavior of religious people. Am I correct?
Yes.
But human beings still have a desire for spirituality. They have a desire to understand the purpose of life. They have a desire to understand the meaning of life. They have a desire to elevate themselves up beyond what Prabhupada always calls eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And so what's being attractive to people today are these two philosophies in various forms. various forms, and often they're presented even as having nothing to do with religion or spirituality. Okay, going on. The most prominent Mayavadi scholar, Sadananda Yogindra. Now, this is interesting because Srila Prabhupada doesn't always identify people by name, especially contemporary people. He tends to avoid mentioning them by name. Has written a book called Vedanta Sada, in which he expounds the philosophy of Sankaracharya, and all the followers of Sankara's philosophy attribute great importance to his statements. In this Vedanta Sara, Sadananda Yogindra defines Brahman as Satchit Ananda combined with knowledge and without duality. Okay? Satchit Ananda combined with knowledge. Now that's awfully strange because chit is already knowledge. Without duality. Just oneness. And he defines ignorance in jada. Jada means like a stone. As knowledge distinct from that of sat and asat. Sat is what exists. Asat is what does not exist. So he's saying knowledge separate from what exists and what does not exist. This is almost inconceivable. Would you agree? We read this all like, what? But it is a product of the three material qualities. So Srila Prabhupada is saying that it sounds like a transcendent philosophy. And it's almost impossible to understand, but it's actually coming from the gunas. Thus, he considers anything other than pure knowledge to be material. So he's considering that what is absolute and what is real is something called pure knowledge, and anything other than that is mundane. The center of ignorance is considered to be sometimes all-pervading and sometimes individual. So he's saying anything other than pure knowledge is ignorance. And this ignorance can either be expansive or individual. Thus, according to his opinion, both the all-pervading Vishnu and the individual living entities are products of ignorance. In simple language, it is the opinion of Sadananda Yogindra. It is the opinion of Sadananda Yogindra that since everything is nirakata, formless, the conception of Vishnu and the conception of the individual soul are both products of ignorance. He also explains that the Vishuddhisattva conception of the Vaishnavas, so Vishuddhisattva is a conception of goodness beyond sattva gun, pure goodness, is nothing but pradhan. Pradhan is the undifferentiated source of creation. I mean, I'm not sure if this is scientifically accurate, but I like to think of it. It's like if you could break up all the atoms and you just had protons, neutrons, and electrons everywhere without, there's no differentiated elements. So he's saying that this concept of the Vaishnavas, of pure goodness, is just the substrate of creation. He maintains that when all-pervading knowledge is contaminated by the Vishuddhisattva, which consists of a transformation of the quality of goodness, there arises the conception of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the omnipotent, omniscient, supreme ruler, the Supersoul, the cause of all causes, the Supreme Ishwara, etc. I wonder if Srila Prabhupada gave that list because he just loves to say nice things about Krishna. Or if he wanted to go on and explain all the ways in which this Mayavadi criticizes Krishna. According to Sadananda Yogindra, because Ishwara, the Supreme Lord, is the reservoir of all ignorance, he may be called Sarvagya, knowing everything, because he knows all ignorance, or omniscient. But one who denies the existence of the omnipotent Supreme Personality of Godhead is more than Ishwara or the Lord. So he thinks he's greater because he's relegating the Lord to the Lord of ignorance. His conclusion, therefore, is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Ishwara, is a transformation of material ignorance, and that the living entity, Jiva, is covered by ignorance. Thus he describes both collective and individual existence in darkness. Is that heavy? Could everybody follow at least a little bit? I know this is very difficult. And there are people who are teaching this right now. I mean, my own guess is that people have some sort of transcendent impersonal experience. where they feel a loss of self and they feel some identification with the Lord. And from this transcendent experience, they come up with these philosophies. Now, in order, it's not just the experiences we have, but it's our ability to understand those experiences. And part of the ability to understand those experiences is by hearing. According to Mayavadi philosophers, the Vaishnava conception of the Lord as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and of the Jiva, or individual soul, as his eternal servant, is a manifestation of ignorance. If we accept the judgment of Lord Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, however, the Mayavadis are to be considered Maya Pradita Jnana, or bereft of all knowledge, because they do not recognize the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or they claim that his existence is a product of the material conception, Maya. These are characteristics of asuras or demons. Also, many philosophers, professors, etc., explain any religion that worships a personal god as just being guilty of anthropomorphism, that we are people, and so we project a personal conception on God. So that's actually quite a similar idea. Yeah. I recently read David Haberman's book, Loving Stones. Any of you familiar with David Haberman? Yeah, I've met him. Yeah. One time when I was in Chaupati, Radhana Swami had him actually speak to the devotees from the Vyasasan. He's initiated in the Pushti Marg of Vallabhacharya. He's also a professor of religion, and he did his PhD thesis on the worship of Govardhan Chilas. And in the book that he produced from that, Loving Stones, he has a whole section about anthropomorphism and how modern philosophies are critical of the worship of a personal god, what to speak of the worship of a personal god in the form of the deity, what to speak of the worship of a personal god in the form of a stone, and how that they consider this the grossest ignorance. So very similar to what we're reading, right? That if you're worshiping God, a personal god, you're in ignorance. If you're worshiping a carved stone that you say looked like God, you're in even deeper ignorance. And if you're just taking a stone and worshiping a god, then you're really, 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 really in ignorance. And that such people make an absolute distinction between matter and spirit, that spirit must be anything that's not matter. They haven't understood any kind of a Ajita-Bheda-Bheda Tattva. Anyway, fascinating exposition. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his discourses with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, said, Jivera Nishtara Lagi Sutra Kaila Vyasa Mayavadi Bhasya Sunye Haya Sarvanasa. Vyasadeva composed the Vedanta Sutra to deliver the conditioned souls from this material world, but Sankaracharya, by presenting the Vedanta Sutra in his own way, has clearly done a great disservice to human society, for one who follows his Mayavada philosophy is doomed. In the Vedanta Sutra, devotional service is clearly indicated, but the Mayavadi philosophers refuse to accept the spiritual body of the Supreme Absolute Person and refuse to accept that the living entity has an individual existence separate from that of the Supreme Lord. Thus, they have created atheistic havoc all over the world, for such a conclusion is against the very nature of the transcendental process of pure devotional service. The Mayavadi philosopher's unrealizable ambition is to become one with the Supreme through denying the existence of the personality of Godhead, results in most calamitous misrepresentation of spiritual knowledge, and one who follows this philosophy is doomed. Now, this is a heavy thing. One who follows this philosophy is doomed to remain perpetually in this material world, as long as you follow that philosophy. In other words, it's not that once you follow that philosophy, you can never get out. But as long as you're following that philosophy, that you think everything is ignorance, then there you are in ignorance. Therefore, the Mayavadis are called Avasuddha Buddhaya, or unclean in knowledge. Because they are unclean in knowledge, all their austerities and penances end in frustration. Thus, although they may be honored at first as very learned scholars, ultimately they descend to physical activities of politics, social work, etc. Now, this is a very important point that Srila Prabhupada makes many times, and I would say probably came from his direct observations. And it's not that Srila Prabhupada is against politics and social work. Right? In the Ishopanishad, he talks about the Ishivashya principle. And, of course, Srila Prabhupada wanted us to establish Varnashram. We're going to be, Krishna willing, giving a lecture on the Varna part this afternoon. So Krishna want, Srila Prabhupada wanted, Krishna wants for there to be devotees in the heads of government. He wants there to be devotees running businesses and agriculture. He wants there to be devotee professors. He wants there to be devotee plumbers and electricians and artists and musicians. It's not that these things are wrong. He wants us to give in charity. In the 18th chapter, he says even great souls should give in charity. So it's not that nobody should engage in politics. I mean, unless you're at the beginning of Satya Yuga where there's no varnashram. And everybody just sits around and meditates and picks fruit from the trees. But the point that Prabhupada's making here is a little different. He's saying that these Mayavadis are saying everything's ignorance, everything's Maya. Any kind of individual work is in ignorance. But they can't maintain that position because it's a false position. And so therefore they come back to do the very work that they've rejected. Do you understand? They said all this work is all nonsense, it's all ignorance. But they can't stay away from it. Instead of becoming one with the Supreme Lord, they again become one with immaterial activities. This is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam 10.2.32. It is the prayers of the demigods. You were right. Aruha krishena parampadam tata pachantiyatona nadutta yusmanangraha. In actuality, the Mayavadi philosophers very strictly follow the austerities and penances of spiritual life. Now that's also a very interesting sentence. Now we're going to think about this. In actuality, the Mayavadi philosophers very strictly, the real ones, not the woo spiritual people that we meet in our, not those people, but the actual Mayavadi philosophers, very strictly follow the austerities and penances of spiritual life, and in this way are elevated to the impersonal Brahman platform, but due to their negligence of the lotus feet of the Lord, they again fall down into material existence. Tanra dosha na hitena agyakari dasha adaye sunyetara haya sarvanasha. Sankaracharya, who is an incarnation of Lord Shiva, is faultless because he is a servant carrying out the orders of the Lord. But those who follow his Mayavadi philosophy are doomed. They will lose all their advancement in the spiritual knowledge. So this point Prabhupada makes that those who take up this philosophy are not able to maintain it is quite an interesting point. So I was visiting a devotee's home some years ago, and they had a book. It was some big, big, big bestseller of this Indian woman in Singapore who'd had a near-death experience and come back in her body. And it was she became very famous because she had died in a hospital from four-stage cancer, and all of her bodily organs had failed. It was a very thoroughly medically documented death. And when she came back from her near-death experiences, within like 2 weeks, she was completely healed. I mean, we went from a total organ failure of all of her organs to complete healing. So anyway, I didn't read the whole book, but I read like the second half of it and ended up watching a little video of this lady, and it was fascinating. So she was an Indian, ethnic Indian, living in Singapore, and she had some impersonalist Buddhist philosophy that she was following. And so when she left her body, she actually had some sort of Brahman, maybe partially Paramatma experience. And she described how that when she was out of her body, that she didn't have a sense of being a separate self, that she had a sense that everybody was one. But she wrote about like if she thought of anybody, she would like become them, that she was everybody and everybody was her. And she said it was a very blissful, peaceful experience, but that she really didn't like the idea that she was everybody and everybody was her. She said, if you're everybody and everybody is you, then you can't have any relationships. So she was married. She said, I decided that I would prefer to have an illusion of separateness because I don't want to give up my relationship with my husband. And so she came back into her body, which then healed. And I thought, this is exactly what Srila Prabhupada talks about. Exactly. That you experience some state where you think you're everybody and everybody is you and everything is one. And you don't want to stay there. You want to come back to have relationships. I read a similar account from another person who also had an experience like that. You know, he said, I decided I would rather have an illusion of having a separate identity so that I can relate with people. Exactly what Prabhupada says over and over and over again. And of course they don't know that there's something higher. So we might ask, why does it matter? Why does it matter what you believe? Just chant Hare Krishna, take prasadam. Why bother with this philosophy? Why bother with the intricacies of philosophy and trying to get the philosophy right? So I want to look at two reasons why it does matter and one reason why it doesn't matter. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So this is going to be a little, this might shake you a little. So if you don't want to be shaken a little, you probably should politely look at your watch or something. Leave them. So the first reason that it matters is that the potency and effect of our practices are directly impacted and affected by what we believe. And evidence for that is right here. The Mayavadis very strictly follow the austerities and penances of spiritual life. Srila Prabhupada is saying that there are Mayavadis who are very strictly following the practices of spiritual life. When Raghunath Bhatta Goswami left home to go see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was this gentleman, Ramdas Vilas, who offered to help him. He was carrying Raghunath Goswami's bags, and he was constantly chanting the name of Ram, Rama, 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 Rama. When they got to Jagannath Puri to see Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu bestowed his blessings on Raghunath Bhatta, but he paid no attention to Ramdas Vishwas. Why? It's possible for our practices to yield different results. Ramdas Vishwas wanted to merge with Ram. So he was chanting for that purpose. Like the Mayavadas, they're practicing. They may be practicing some of the same things that we do. In fact, some of them may be stricter than some of us. But their purpose is different. This is called the sankalpa. What is your aim? What is your intention? Now, just having an intention isn't enough. If you say, I would like to become a medical doctor, and you never go to medical school, that's not going to work. But if you want to become a medical doctor so you can learn how to murder people more effectively, that's also not going to work either. It's what is your intention, yeah? Intention and practices go together. It's not one or the other. Intention by itself is useless. That's just mode of ignorance determination. Oh, I'd like to become spiritual someday. But even if you're doing... Do we have many examples in the Shastra of people, of demons, who perform great Shastric austerities? Yeah, I mean, some of them do their own made-up things like Rikasura, but a lot of them actually perform the austerities of the Shastra. And do they get powers that they misuse?
Yes.
Yeah. It's entirely, entirely possible if you have the wrong intent, if you have the wrong understanding, to misuse the potency that comes from the practices. And I've thought about this quite deeply. The spiritual practices we do in our Hare Krishna movement are not radically different from those of any other religion, are they? Are they? Everyone does some sort of worship, usually with some sort of fire is involved. And they chant some sort of prayers, individually and collectively, and they read some sort of scriptures, and they observe festivals related to the people in their line, and they go to the holy places related to the people in their line. I mean, that's not that different. And you might say, well, the Hare Krishna mantra is especially potent, always. Our acharyas say that the name can be just the alphabet, if it's not infused with any intention. Or it can be offensive. Yes? Then you might say, well, like the people we're meeting on the street, like we go out and do Harinam, or the people to whom we give prasadam, they have no philosophical understanding, they have no intention. but we do. You follow? Srila Prabhupada does. Our practices have been infused with his potency, and we in turn are supposed to infuse them with our potency. So therefore, even if the people hearing us or the people eating the prasadam, even if they don't have a proper philosophical understanding and they don't have a proper sankalpa, they will still get benefit by ours. At least they'll get an abbas, at least they'll get a reflection or a shadow. But it's not just the practices, it's the practices with the proper mentality. Therefore, devotional service, not just service, but devotional service, and not just devotion, but devotional service. If one has the wrong mood, right? Yeah, tamam prapajante, tam sataiva bhajamyam. If you're chanting Hare Krishna, I mean, at this one class where Prabhupada said, if you're chanting with offenses, it just gives you material results. You know, if you're like, oh, Hare Krishna, you know, I want to have a beautiful mansion by the ocean. I mean, it might not get you that in this life, but it will get you that. Does that make sense to everybody? So it matters. Now, again, if you just have philosophy, that's useless if you don't act on it. But the practices we do, although they have potency in and of themselves, we also have to respond to them. And we can also say the holy name is a person who responds to us, who responds to our desires, who responds to our intention, who responds to our understanding. It's not just something mechanical. I mean, think of all the ways in which Srila Prabhupada talked about the practices we do to be not potent. He talks about professional Bhagavatam reciters, that you won't gain any benefit. You can actually get harmed, like milk touched by the lips of a serpent. I once read about this Christian preacher who had become an atheist, but he still kept being a Christian preacher because that was how he made his living. He didn't know what else. And he said after a while, his wife said to him, you know, if you can be a professional Christian, you could be a professional atheist. So he decided to preach atheism and started making his living that way. But what potency would it have if some atheist is preaching the Bible? You follow? Well, what potency would it have? It wouldn't have any. In fact, it could even be harmful. Prabhupada talks about people who use, you know, Bhakti Santa actually uses shalagram to crack nuts. So, talks about how the holy dhams can be covered by the sins of the people, and the real value of the dham is in the saintly person's there. Everybody has read this? Yeah. Although these practices are spiritual in and of themselves, being spiritual, they're also persons. And they can withdraw or show themselves according to who's relating with them and how they're relating with them. So unless a person is relating with them spiritually, they don't show their full glory. And they can even withdraw completely. Don't we do that? If someone's dealing with us in a nasty way, or what to speak of in like a really abusive or aggressive or violent way, don't we withdraw? We don't show ourselves. So why wouldn't God do that? Now, in extreme cases, which is what's happening here, you can have a wolf in sheep's clothing. You can have something that's actually extremely demoniac, asuram bhava mashritam, and atheistic, that looks like spirituality. So it may not be just some, you know, gross materialist who's misusing spirituality for some material benefit, but it can be someone who's actively propagating atheism, but it looks like something spiritual. Now, from my experience, I would say that a lot of people doing this in 2023 are more or less innocent. In other words, they don't hate God. They're not trying to destroy God. They've been fooled by someone. And the philosophies like this that are very common, I'm seeing, are primarily some form of Gyan Yoga or Dhyan Yoga. That's Karma Yoga is not so popular. Where in Gyan Yoga, part of Gyan Yoga is you become detached. You see yourself as the observer. And you become detached from your thoughts, feelings, and desires. And of course, Gyan Yoga is you meditate, and you with pranayama, with asana, and so forth, you regulate your life airs and mechanically go into a trance. So either one of those, either Gyan Yoga or Gyan Yoga, can put a person at least into sattva-guna. And for most people running around in 2023, sattva-guna is pretty far out. It's like, whoa, I feel peaceful, I feel happy, all of a sudden my body's working properly. I can see things in the right perspective. Like Krishna says, you see what is to be done, what is not to be done, what is binding, what is liberating. And so it's very easy to mistake sattva-guna as spiritual. So a lot of these people are just receiving some glimpse of sattva-guna in their daily meditation practice or in their various practices of Gyan Yoga. But when you read the philosophies behind the people teaching a lot of this stuff, it's very much like what Srila Prabhupada's saying in this purport. You know, you step back and you become the observer and you just observe your thoughts, feelings, and desires. Fine, that's wonderful. We have that in the Bhagavad Gita too, that's part of our bhakti yoga process. And you start to realize that you're the self separate from the body and mind. Okay, great. So far, so good. Then as you become expert, you start to realize that there is no observer self. Huh? Who is realizing that there's no observer self? Who? I realize that there's no I? And they start teaching these kind of philosophies. Or you meditate and you become God. Now, of course, what sometimes happens is the opposite of what I said in the beginning. I met this one man who was a Buddhist teacher of Vipassana Yoga for 20 years. And he said that one time when he was meditating, he actually had a vision of Krishna. So somehow, because he was engaging in potent practices with an aim of spiritual enlightenment, even though he didn't believe in God, he must not have been offensive. Anyway, so he came to the Hare Krishna temple. He said, "You guys are right." Anyway, so spirituality can, the philosophy can matter, because something that looks like spirit can be actually atheistic. Now, we certainly are happy, we in the Hare Krishna movement are very happy that people are interested in Gyan Yoga and Gyan Yoga, because the parts of that are part of our bhakti process. And if we can take people who are more or less innocent and show them how everything they're trying to achieve in Gyan Yoga and Gyan Yoga is perfectly achieved in bhakti. That's not so easy, but when we can do that, it's very successful. All right, now there are times when philosophy doesn't matter. And I've already mentioned one of them, and that is when our practices are enthused by the intent and philosophy of a great soul. So when we go out on Harinam and we distribute prasadam, the philosophy of the people who are on the receiving end is irrelevant. Because they're getting that infusion from Srila Prabhupada and those of us who are doing our best to follow. Now that's not going to be long term for them. At a certain point, they have to pick up their own understanding. Yeah? Make sense? Like, when I went to school, they had these things called cliff notes, where they'd be summaries of classic books. So if you wanted to cheat and not read the classic book for school, you just read the notes. But ultimately, if you wanted to understand, you had to really read the book and study the book. You couldn't just go by somebody else's outline to get a deep understanding. Now, the other sense in which this doesn't matter is a lot of details of our philosophy don't matter. They really don't. Like there's a purport in the fourth canto where Srila Prabhupada says that you can travel to outer space by machines, you can travel to outer space by training pigeons, you can travel to outer space by mantra, or you can travel to outer space in some spiritual vehicle. People do not have to believe the training pigeons part in order to chant Hare Krishna nicely. I mean, I personally have a hard time with it. I grew up in New York City. There were lots of pigeons, and I just can't imagine going into Times Square and training the pigeons to take me to Jupiter. I'm just like... And somebody that, if someone says, well, I find that a little unbelievable, we'll say, that's fine, doesn't matter. You follow what I'm saying? Or, you know, that Ugrasena had 4 quadrillion bodyguards, and you're like, where? You know, Sataputra, my godbrother Sataputra Prabhu explains how they must have existed in some subtle sphere. It must not have been all humans walking around on the planet. But some devotees asked Srila Prabhupada about this and said, people are, they don't have faith when we say this. And Prabhupada said, well, why are you telling them that? He said, tell them some other portion. And there are parts of our philosophy that are inconceivable. They're just inconceivable. We can't fully understand them with our human brain, especially in Kali Yuga. We just can't. Like a chintabeta, that's why I called it chintabeta beta tantra. So Sataputra used to give the example that, you know, all the universes are inside Krishna. Okay. All right. You got that? Like you can look in Krishna's mouth and you see all the universes. Is that, we can picture that, right? Okay. Then within each atom of the universe is Krishna. Can you separately picture that? So within every atom here, there's Krishna. You can get that, right? Okay. So now within every atom, there's Krishna, and within Krishna, there's the universe. Oops. How do those two things exist simultaneously? I mean, Mother Yasoda got really bewildered about this. She looked in his mouth and she saw herself. She didn't see a picture of herself or a movie of herself. She actually saw herself. And Lord Brahma was bewildered by this. And he said, I can't figure it out. He said, how did Mother Yasoda see herself? He said, how am I existing within you and yet I'm talking to you outside? So if someone says, well, I can't figure that out, you'll say, yeah. No, I can't figure it out. Yeah. You just appreciate it. Or one thing we were discussing is, with some leaders, is, you know, the how, where, when a jiva becomes conditioned by maya. We tend to fight about this, but Srila Prabhupada writes in his purport to Bhagavad Gita 13:20, it is really not important how the jiva got conditioned by maya. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, in his Jiva Dharma, chapter 15, that this is inconceivable. It can't be understood by a conditioned soul. So all he said, all the devotees try to explain this in various ways, but it actually can't be understood. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also writes, he says, it's inconceivable. Bhaktivinoda said, this is understandable in samadhi, under the chit shakti of the Lord. Then one can experience it. I mean, we have examples in our life of things that cannot be properly communicated, experiences that cannot be properly communicated, even very simple ones. Like, what does a mango taste like? You have to taste it. I mean, you can't really communicate it. Even people who write restaurant reviews and who have a huge vocabulary for describing the textures and tastes of foods, ultimately you have to taste it. So certain things we can understand by logic and reason, and certain things we can't. We can understand up to a point. We can understand certain parts of it. But we say, well, but if it's like that, what about this, and what about this, and what about this, and what about this, and what about this? And there are some aspects of our philosophy that are really not very important, as Prabhupada says. They're just not very important. And we can get the main gist of it, and that's it. And then there are certain things that are very important. And if we don't have those right, then we may be doing our practices and going in the wrong direction. Things that are explained in our shastras that are very time, place, and circumstance. You know, brahmacharya should wear deer skin and matted hair. That's not important. In fact, not only is it not important, but Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't like that, even though it's right there in the Bhagavatam. And, of course, Burajan asked Srila Prabhupada, how do you know what's a principle and what's a detail? And Prabhupada said, that requires intelligence. Of course, we have a list from Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur of what are the 10 universal, eternal, transcontextual truths. And he got his list from Baladeva Vibhushana, who's kind of the link between the Madhva Sampradaya and the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And Baladeva Vibhushana got his list from Ananda Tirtha, one of the main disciples of Madhvacharya. What are the elements of philosophy that are universal, eternal, and transcontextual? That without understanding them, it's going to be very difficult to gain the result that we want from our spiritual practice. And it's going to be very difficult to infuse our spiritual practice with the proper sankalpa and the proper mood. So that is very important to understand. So therefore, although purports like this are complicated and difficult and intellectually challenging, undoubtedly they are, and they require, you know, you could spend a few hours just getting into what is Srila Prabhupada talking about. This chapter is worth studying and understanding because we are facing this in our modern day, these different distortions of philosophy. We're facing it all around us. And because we really want to make sure that we understand things clearly in our own practice of bhakti. So, of course, what I'm saying implies that we do something radical in 2023, and that is read books. I think a lot of people at the modern day, they just watch 90-second videos. Yeah? But to actually read Srila Prabhupada's books. And not only to read them once, but to read them again, and to read them with the devotees. And to discuss them with the devotees. And of course, to hear Srila Prabhupada's lectures, to hear Srila Prabhupada's conversations and morning walks, and to be getting ourselves thoroughly grounded in this understanding, so that the things we do, that we will, they will respond with us, that the holy name will respond with us, the prasadam will respond with us, the deities will, they will respond with us, because we're approaching them in the right way, with the right attitude and the right sankalpa and the right understanding. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
First of all, it's really amazing how each one of your classes is always amazing. Thank you.
Well, that's just because you love me. That's she's an old friend.
Regarding the books of Srila Prabhupada, I notice he often quotes Chanakya Pandit, which I really, really don't like. And there are things that Chanakya Pandit says that really touch my core values, and I feel like when Prabhupada quotes him, I get upset. I feel like, why is Prabhupada quoting such a man, you know? And then I asked Radhanath Swami, and he said that actually Chanakya Pandit was not a saintly person, he was just like a moral politician, something correct, like that. But a few days ago, in the sixth canto, I read that Prabhupada said that Chanakya Pandit was a sage, so then I went back into my confusion.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you're talking about something that's not very important. This is in the not very important category. What Chanakya Pandit says is not eternal, universal, transcontextual truths, whatever he may have been. So in order to help people achieve the universal, eternal, transcontextual truths, it's helpful to have a society that's peaceful. And so Srila Prabhupada saw that in the world, he saw it in India also, and he saw it as he traveled in the world, that society was disordered. And so Srila Prabhupada spent quite a lot of time and effort and energy in talking about how to have a peaceful society. And a lot of the ways he explained that make sense to us and are welcomed by us, and a lot of the ways he explained it irritate us, depending on where we're coming from. In our hermeneutics class, we have a really nice lesson 7, where we deal specifically with a lot of these things. And it's good to remember that when Prabhupada first started teaching about a simple, more natural way of life in the 60s and 70s, that was not only not popular, it was considered grossly antisocial. We were going to have better living through chemistry. You know, we were all going to get on the Starship Enterprise and have computer-synthesized food. and that was going to be a great advancement in life. And we were going to, through antibiotics and vaccines and DDT, we were going to wipe out all the diseases on the planet. And so if you talked about living green, I don't think you used that term then, but if you talked about living green, you were antisocial, you were anti-progress. So what's considered on a social level to be good in society and bad in society is constantly changing. You know, Prabhupada talked about when he was growing up, people were married very, very young. And basically, you know, Bhakti Vinod married at 14, Lord Chaitanya married at 14, Gandhi married at 13. But now that's considered horrible, criminal, actually. So, you know, there was a time when that was considered the responsible way to take care of your children and have a sane, stable society. And now it's considered literally child abuse. So things shift, you know, what we consider. And so what we're going to read from what Prabhupada's quoting, that inflames us, that we're going to say, well, this is just wrong. Either something that we think is logically wrong, like pigeons flying you to Jupiter, or something morally wrong, like you can't trust women. Then, and our reaction to that is going to depend on what culturally at our time is considered good and bad. Now let's look at that can't trust women, because that's probably the one you're talking about, right? You're talking about a different one?
Yeah, I'm talking about Chanakya Pandit saying that there are three things that you can beat: a wife, a dog, and a drum.
Oh, that one. You're going to ask me that one publicly. You are going to ask me that one publicly. Oh, boy. Okay. The other one I could deal with easily. This one's a little more difficult. Yeah, but Prabhupada says that only uncivilized people do that. And if in a civilized country such a thing happens, there should be a court case. And the way Prabhupada responded practically to women whose husbands were beating them was to immediately tell them to leave the situation. But in Prabhupada talking about it, he said, so that was his... Prabhupada didn't accept Chanakya Pandita's Shastra. Is that right?
But he's quoting them in the Bhagavatam, which becomes Shastra, and people tend to follow it because they say Prabhupada said...
Yes, I'm very aware of that. Extremely aware, actually. Personally aware.
Well, one viewpoint could be that at that time, when did Chanakya Pandita live?
4 B.C.
Long time ago. Maybe if a woman was unfaithful to her husband, and her husband was a good husband, maybe it would be the right thing to do.
I have a hard time finding this the right thing to do, even in that sort of case. Sorry. I find that a little hard. But it is a good point you make there, that we have the story in Chaitanya Charitamrita about Subhuti Roy, which is a very interesting story. So Subhuti Roy was a Hindu, and he had a Muslim servant. And at one point, he beat this Muslim servant. And he beat him so badly that the servant had scars on his back. So later, you know, the Muslim servant actually stopped being a servant and became something else.
He
became a king? Went from being a servant to being a king? It's pretty far out. Anyway, he became some big thing. And his wife one day said, "What are these scars on your back?" And he said, "Oh, Subhuti Roy beat me when I was his servant." And she said, "Well, you should immediately kill him." He said, "No, no, no, I'm not." He said, "He was like a father to me. I'm not going to hold this against him." And then she said, "Well, then you should turn him into a Mohammedan." Which in those days, all you had to do was take water that a Mohammedan had drunk and throw it on a Hindu, and then the Hindu was a Mohammedan. You didn't need much of a conversion strategy. Just go around throwing water at people. And so Subhuti Roy didn't know what to do. Now he had lost his caste, and so he went to these brahmanas who said, drink hot ghee, drink boiling ghee, in other words, commit suicide. That's also interesting. And then he went to Lord Chaitanya, who said, no, just take sannyas and go to Vrindavan. So all kinds of weird things come out of this story. Why are these brahmanas telling somebody to commit suicide just because he had some water sprinkled on him? That's like really weird. And then the other really weird thing coming out of that story is that it was clearly socially acceptable to beat your servants to the point that you made scars on their back. It was obviously, it was part of the social climate. Does that mean that was good? By the way, are there things going on in our modern society that are heinous?
Yes.
That are just an integral part of our society? Is that pretty much always true in history? Can you think of any point in history except maybe the beginning of Satyayuga where that's not true? That certain things are normalized in a society that are actually heinous? And these things shift. I mean, one example is slavery. So it wasn't that long ago when slavery was normal in society. And I'm sure some people thought it was a good thing and other people thought, well, it's not great, but it's the way things have always been. And other people thought this is horrible and we should change it. You all know that the lithium batteries in our phone are most likely the result of horrible forced child labor. Yes? Everybody knows that? Why do you have a phone? Why do you have a phone? Was Prabhupada saying that as a prescriptive thing or as a descriptive thing? There's in ISKCON Communications Journal 13, I have an article there about using hermeneutics to explain two difficult statements. One is Srila Prabhupada's statement in 620 Bhagavad Gita that we should be callous, and another is explaining from the ninth canto the story of human trafficking and human sacrifice that was attended by all the demigods. We all thought it was great. So I go through and I use ISKCON hermeneutics, which I wanted to teach in London, and I was supposed to teach in London, and somehow it didn't happen. But anyway. And I use that to do what's called an exegesis, where you go through these statements and you actually explain how we can understand them. So I would say the same thing would need to be done for a statement like that. But my initial reaction is that, first of all, Srila Prabhupada said that this was wrong and it should be a court case. To be taken to court, the woman should leave. In practice, he never accepted such a thing, ever. And that Prabhupada may quote people or refer to things as a descriptive, not a prescriptive. Even the Bhagavatam, I mean, it's not suggesting that we should sacrifice our son to Varuna or that we should go buy people to sacrifice if we don't want to sacrifice our son. Is he okay? Is that all right? Is he okay? Were we talking about things that were too heavy? Hope you're okay. Again, these are not like core things of philosophy. You know, they're just not. It's something that's where Prabhupada's commenting on something. And one has to understand what is Prabhupada's intention and how did Prabhupada actually behave. Like we could, you know, we can say there are children being forced, young children being forced against their will to work in horrendous condition in mines in Africa in order to mine the rare minerals for lithium batteries. So I just said that. Does that mean I think it's okay? Or if I say that all of us accept that we are indirectly contributing to heinous activities in order to live like that one. Is that true? That's true, isn't it? we're accepting that we can't do anything about it, that in order to live our lives, in order to function in this society, we have to indirectly contribute to heinous activities. Is that a fact? Is that an objective fact?
Yes.
Does that mean I'm saying that we should do that? I'm saying that that's... But you could take that out of context and say, oh, therefore we should do that. It's unfortunate that it's almost impossible to lead a purely pure life in 2023. How are you going to do it? You know, you're going to live on an island somewhere by yourself and just live on coconuts? No, it's extremely difficult. Even, I mean, it's hard for me to think of any exceptions. You know, the devotees I know who separate themselves from society and live, you know, in the middle of nowhere and eschew most of modern technology and so forth, end up needing some relationship with the world in general in order to live and in order to maintain the temples. Yes?
Yeah.
And as soon as you do that, you're likely to be in touch with something that is involving something that is involving some horrific sinful activity somewhere. Like people who are really strict vegans, you know, they have trouble finding the right tires for their car. You follow? It's all, so I see this as mostly observational. My personal conviction is that you can take any troublesome statement from Srila Prabhupada or Acharyas in the Shastra, and using proper hermeneutics, you can understand it in such a way that you preserve the eternal, universal, transcontextual truth. And there will always be people who take these other statements and misuse them for their own purposes. Yes.
Thank you for the class. So I was wondering, why is it that the most scientists, they feel more inclined for the ascending process? And how would you explain that the descending... No, sorry, the other way around. They're more inclined to have this way, ascending process. So how can we convince them in an easy way to make the descending process?
Well, you're putting all the scientists into one big lump. I know many, many theistic scientists and many Hare Krishna scientists. I assume you're talking about hard scientists, not soft scientists. Although I'm a soft scientist. I'm a social scientist. How to convince them? I mean, I was just reading this thing how, you know, the physicists, astrophysicists say that at most they can perceive 5% of the matter in the universe. And even that they don't know, because you don't know how much you don't know. You don't know how much there is. So you don't know how much you're perceiving. And you can look at one of the faults of empiricism. So just to very briefly, so like when I was at the master's level, they're telling us, you know, this is a fact, and this is a fact, and this is a fact, this is a fact. And then you get up to the PhD level, and we were studying the philosophy of science, the philosophy of research. And the first thing they tell you are all the flaws with empirical research. So anybody who actually gets up to that level of science understands that there's flaws in empirical research, and they're insurmountable flaws. Correlation doesn't equal causation. How do you always know what's the causation? There's an infinite number of stories you can have about the same set of facts. We all experience that in our life, right? Something happens and 10 different people have 10 different stories about what it means. Or, you know, detectives go to investigate a case and they look at the facts and it points them in 10 different directions. We're looking at everything through, we're just talking about cultural biases. We're looking at everything through a cultural bias. We're looking at everything through personal bias. There are others. The biggest problem with empirical knowledge is that all you can say with empirical knowledge is, so far we have not found it to be false. you can never say about anything empirical, it's true. That's like one of the principles of scientific research. You can never say, this is true. You can say, so far, we haven't found it to be false. And many things they think are true, later they find to be false. Now the problem is that what constitutes an absolute proof? Raja Vidya Raja Guyam Prachaksha Vatman Karmam Susukam Kartamanyam. Prachaksha. The only thing that will constitute an absolute proof for any of us is our direct experience of spirituality. If I say to you, I've seen Krishna, that may, if you believe me and you have faith in me, that may be evidence for you that Krishna is real. Like this Buddhist meditator who saw Krishna. That's evidence for me, but it's not proof for me, is it? Is that proof? Maybe he's lying. Maybe what he thought was Krishna was something else, who knows? But it's evidence. The only ultimate proof for us is our own experience. And that's only a proof for us personally. Which is why ultimately, all of this can only be understood through direct perception. Raja Vidya Raja Yam Pavitra Nida Mutam Prachek Shavagamam Dhammam Susukam Kartamam. Prabhupada would often say, well, we understand our advancement not by a certificate from others, but by our practical experience, just like when you're eating food, which we're about to do. You know, you get nourished, you get relief from hunger, you get satisfaction. And you don't have to ask somebody, unless you have some sort of metabolic disease, you don't have to ask somebody, excuse me, have I eaten enough? Am I satisfied? I think the ultimate argument is that if you really want to find truth, you need to be in a process that's going to give you a direct experience of truth. And hard science is never going to do that. It can't. If there's a very complicated design on a fabric and you just look at a little piece of it, you're never going to understand the whole thing. Which is very nicely explained in Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions. How whatever scientific theory is prevalent at the particular time only explains a part of reality. There's always things that it can't explain. And as those things that it can't explain become more and more dominant, the whole paradigm has to shift. But when the paradigm shifts, it shifts to seeing another part of reality, which is still not explaining other parts of reality. If one wants to see reality in total, then one has to be in touch with reality in total, which is God. And he has to decide whether or not to show it to you. And there's just no other way to do it. But then you have to have faith. You have to have faith that there is some absolute reality, and you have to have faith that there's a process by which you could experience that absolute reality. So we try to give people a little taste of that, with the holy name, with prasadam, with philosophy, where they can have some experience beyond the mundane. And to what extent they get experience beyond the mundane is going to have a lot to do with our personal purity and our personal connection with persons such as Srila Prabhupada who have purity. So that's going to be the main way you're going to convince people, is by a personal direct experience. So I'll end with this. I like to tell this story. I was in Puerto Rico and we were distributing, I was giving a university lecture and this devotee had made some cookies to distribute. And I was in the kitchen when she was cooking, so I saw her cooking the cookies. It was butter and sugar and flour and, you know, it was like baking soda, maybe a little vanilla. That was it, like the simplest possible recipe that gets you a cookie, or biscuit, sorry. Gets you a biscuit. In America, biscuits are an entirely different matter. So we had a bunch of these biscuits at the university program. And I didn't get to taste any because I gave the lecture and then I was talking to people afterwards. I don't know, 120 people were there, professors and students. At least 40 people came up to me and said, can I get the recipe? And I'm thinking, really? Because they had an experience that couldn't be explained by the ingredients. If you told them the recipe, they'd go, no. Like, I remember when I had a sandesh, and I'd been a professional chef. And I come back and I say, what's in this? Milk and sugar. I'm like, nah. A little lemon. I said, maybe. Wow, thanks. Yes, that occurred to me.
Yeah, I was going to say about the cell phones. Well, he was in England one time on the Kuda. He asked about the microphone, saying that, well, this is loud. It's always too loud. Everyone's aggressive. Prabhupada was here in England, and Mukunda Prabhu at the time, he said, if everything can be used in Krishna's service, and then he said, we're using a microphone, and Prabhupada said, well, everybody who manufactured the microphone gets some benefit. So if we're using the cell phone in Krishna's service to preach to people, or whatever it is, then the people that are working in the mines are getting some benefit.
That's true, but that doesn't mean that we condone the way they're being treated in the mines. This was
no,
my
of
point.
Of course not, but what are we going to do about it? But they want to do it often, they get money.
Yeah, but those children don't want
to. Another thing is, I used to get beaten in school. I don't have a grudge against the people that beat me, but I went to a private school, and the prefects, the senior boys in the school, they could beat you if you didn't do the right thing. So, you know, at the time, I mean, even Prabhupada quotes the adage, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child. We're just living in different times nowadays. People are very, you know, because people have been abused, and obviously you can abuse physical, you know, punishment, but at the same time, it was a way that people, I mean, even in the Manu Samhita, somebody's a thief, you cut their hand off. Not that you stone women if they're unfaithful, but, you know, if you beat them, maybe they'll stop being unfaithful, and maybe it'll be better for the better for the family. Hare Krishna.
Thank you for opening that up again. I really appreciate that, bro. I'm just going to reiterate that what is culturally good at one time and place is culturally abhorrent at another time and place. And in any particular time and place, we're going to see certain things as culturally good or culturally abhorrent, which 20 years before and 20 years later will not be the case. And so if we look at things through the lens of our current culture, we are going to see certain things as intrinsically wrong or intrinsically good differently than somebody will look at them, has looked at them 20 years before us or 20 years after us. Some of the things that are very accepted now in modern society will be considered culturally abhorrent and morally abhorrent 20 years from now. Absolutely guarantee that. Some of the things that any of us think, oh, this is totally fine, 20 years from now, people are going to go, that's horrific. How could you possibly do that? So are there absolute standards of what is proper and improper social behavior? Eh.
Isn't that Sanatana Dharma?
Sanatana Dharma are principles. So this afternoon at the Sunday feast, I'm going to talk about 9 principles of career dharma or varna dharma. Those are principles. You want to have another example? All right, so there's a wedding going on. And at this wedding, there's a chess game going on. At this chess game, somebody is cheating. And they keep cheating. And a voice eventually comes from the sky, they're cheating. The person who was cheated takes a club, hits them over the head, and kills them. And nobody batted an eye. And Prabhupada said, this was not uncommon at such your weddings. Which I'm beating. Killed him. You can say, well, it's Balaram. But that wasn't, Prabhupada said, it's not uncommon except your weddings.
Yeah. And kidnapping also.
Yeah, you know, and you're taking, even if you didn't kidnap her, even if she chose you, you're taking her away on the chariot and the other suitors are coming and you're shooting them and you're maiming them. How'd you lost your hand? You know, it was a fight for a bride. And it's not a criminal case. You know, in America with Alexander Hamilton, I mean, this is just 150 years ago, So there was a duel. And it was not a murder case. To settle a quarrel with a duel was legal. Believe me, that would not be legal now. But it was. It was, that kind of thing was legal in Europe, which the UK is technically part of Europe, but anyway. Although everybody here talks about Europe as if it's someplace else. But you know, there were things that were cultural norms that now were like, I mean, it would be a criminal case. Somebody would be in jail for life. And similarly, there are things right now that we consider just completely fine that people would have been executed for 100 years ago. It goes both ways. And I think it's difficult to take our current standards of what is and is not morally acceptable in terms of details and impose them on another time. Believe me, you know, those, any of you who live to be my age, you'll see that the things that you consider right now, that culturally right now, will become not so. Things will shift. And you'll be like, what happened to the world? You'll start feeling more and more uncomfortable in the world. It's like, that's not right. That's not right. That's not right. So, a lot of times this is just, again, descriptive, not prescriptive. Yes, Prabhu. Nice to see you again, by the way, after so long.
Just thinking, one example of the changing values here in central London in the late 18th and 19th century. Outside the pubs was generally a sign. It said, no dogs, no blacks, and no Irish.
Wow.
That was here in central London.
Wow.
No blacks, no dogs, and no Irish.
No Irish. Wow. Wow. And it was normal. Again, I'm sure some people thought it was horrible. So some people thought it was good. Right? Some people thought it was good. Some people just thought, well, like the way we think about kids, you know, forced slave labor in African minds. Some people think, well, it's bad, but it's unavoidable. I don't know what to do about it. I can't do anything about it. And some people actually fight against it and eventually get it changed. And that's always true. In every society, there's stuff going on that's, some people think is good, some people think it's bad, but they have to tolerate it, and some people think, yes, this is bad, and I'm going to change it, and this keeps shifting. And the very thing that's considered important, like Prabhupada said, his mother was going to kill herself if her 12-year-old daughter wasn't married. That was how you protected your daughter. It was how you made sure she had a happy life. It was how you protected society. It was your important duty to your child. You were a bad parent if you didn't do that. And now if you did that, you'd be an evil parent. You'd be arrested. So, does this make some sense? Yeah? We have a whole hermeneutics lesson on this. It's after 9. Yeah? And I'm going to get in trouble for violating a local norm if I keep on talking. The only question I want to ask is anybody at this point extremely disturbed? An honest answer. Is there anyone here who's extremely disturbed? Honesty. Is anybody? Okay. Do all of you have at least some relative beginning peace with this stuff? Thanks so much for bringing this. I love you too, Anderson. Right?
I mean, I won't say disturbed, but then what we've heard or learned in the past, and excuse me because this might be a very nice point here.
Hold on. Don't hold it too close.
I get nervous talking on mic, so. So, like I said, excuse me, this might be a very naive point of view.
But that's fine. I just didn't want to end if there was anybody that was still very disturbed. That would be fine.
Right, so what we've heard in the past, and I was born in a place near Mathura, so this is Malapur, him, that I keep coming back to him.
But what we have learned in the past is either it's Gyan Marg or Bhakti Marg or Dhyan Marg. They say it's eventually leading you to the same thing. But you know, this is the time, and I don't know, it's just a coincidence, beautiful lecture by you, that this point came up again. This has been going in my head for months. What's right? So are there any recommendation or books that you can go through to and get it clarified? And I think the point of view where you said that if you taste something, that's when you know how, you know, the experience, so that's very beautiful. So can I read books, get more clarity? Because then you're confused as to what's right, what's wrong, but we've heard that all three marks are eventually...
Well, there's the fourth one, of course, Karma Yoga. Krishna says very clearly in the fifth chapter that both Karma Yoga and Sankhya, and Sankhya is actually a mixture of Dhyan, and Bhakti from Kapila Dev, will take you to the same place, but you have to have the right Sankalpa. You have to have the right Sankalpa. If you're engaging in these processes with the idea that ultimately there's no God and ultimately there's no soul, and by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, I'm going to realize that I don't exist and God doesn't exist, then you're not going to get to the same place because you don't want to get to the same place. The only way you might get to the same place is if you get some sort of extraordinary mercy, or if you're just kind of innocent and you don't really know what you're doing. And our understanding, our Gaudiya Vaishnava understanding, is that there has to be some touch of bhakti in the other paths in order for them to ultimately bring you to love for Bhagavan. Which makes sense. It's kind of like saying there has to be some desire for love in order to bring you to love. There has to be some touch of working on love in order to bring you to love. Without that, you might get a kind of, you might come to just sattva-gun, or you might get just some Raman realization, like I talked about, that people even achieve that. And they say, you know, I'd rather have illusion relationships than just even this sort of ecstatic peace. So what we're presenting, and I didn't have time to get into this in depth in this class, but we're presenting a whole realm of detailed and deep emotions in bhakti. And yes, any of the paths of yoga can take you there, but if you have to know where you're going, you have to want to go there. And there has to be some touch of that devotion in your path. And our own recommendation is that if you do uttam bhakti, if you do pure bhakti, that's not covered by jnana and karma and yoga, that includes aspects of karma yoga, includes aspects of jnana yoga, it includes aspects of jnana yoga, but it's not covered by them, that your path will be easier and quicker, because what you're practicing is very similar to what you want to achieve. Whereas with the other three, what you're practicing is quite different from what you want to achieve. It's more like a means to an end. Is that helpful? And as far as reading, I mean, Srila Prabhupada has a whole lot of books. Bhagavad Gita is a good place to start. I've written a novel that deals with this called Essence Seekers, if you want to check that out.
Sorry, say that again?
It's called Essence Seekers. It's a form of a novel, and I deal with these four paths. So again, thank you very much, and someday I'll memorize the Sanskrit verse, but anything good in this lecture came from Srila Prabhupada, anything bad came from me. Please take the good and leave the bad. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.